Welcome to The Intended Parent, our podcast about our journeys to motherhood through the gift of surrogacy. We hope to open up the conversation around infertility, bust some of the myths you may have heard about, and share our stories with heart and honesty. We'll tell you about the highs, the lows, the ins, the outs, and everything in between. Happy listening!
In this episode, I chat to Krina about her cancer diagnosis and the subsequent heart failure that led to her infertility. But before we start, a word of warning. Krina talks openly about all that happened to her, and to be honest, at times it's a hard listen. If this isn't going to help you at this time, you might want to come back to it when you're ready, listen in bite-sized chunks, or skip past it altogether. It's important to us that although we are very honest about our journeys, we never want to negatively impact anyone who listens.
Found out you had breast cancer at 33.
That's right, yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So I guess, you know, like so many of us, I was a healthy young woman in my 30s. And, you know, I'd had a couple of years, my husband and I had been married, we'd been travelling around the world. And we were kind of doing what every other, well, not every other, but what most 30-year-olds would aspire to do. You know, we were saving towards a house and wanting to see the world, and you know, we quit our jobs and backpacked and had the adventure of a lifetime. And we returned to England in 2011. No, we returned to England in 2012. And I sort of got back onto the employment game, and I was working, you know, as an accountant in for an insurance company. And one weekend, I'd sort of was getting dressed and noticed that my nipple had inverted on my left breast, and I didn't take any notice of it whatsoever. I just thought I had worn a very ill-fitting bra or some sort of a top that for some reason would invert my nipple. Now, as someone who's had breast cancer, that sounds like the most ludicrous of thoughts that a bra could ever cause, like yeah. An inverted nipple. But, you know, that's how I rationalised it at the time. And I left it for a number of weeks. And then one day, Satty actually turned around. Satty's my husband. And said to me, you probably should get that seen to by a doctor because it's not right that that would happen for so long. And it just made me think a little bit. So it was a Saturday, so there was obviously no doctors around, and I decided to talk to Dr. Google, who is obviously everyone's best friend. Yeah. And I put the symptoms in and I said, you know, what could an inverted nipple mean?
Can I just actually just stop you there?
Yeah.
Because as somebody who hasn't ever had an inverted nipple, what does an inverted nipple look like? Are we talking completely?
It was
out?
Not completely inside out. Probably sort of like 2/3 of the nipple had been sucked in
right.
towards my breast tissue, okay. I guess. And yeah, so it looked odd, and
yeah.
In hindsight, it felt odd because there had been pain there, but. Again, something I'd ignored for quite a while, really. And then, yeah, so I had Googled it on a Sunday night. I remember something like DIY SOS was on, so I was already half crying anyway. And read this sort of blurb about it being a sign of breast cancer. And then it said if you've got pain in the area. And then it sort of all started to trigger alarm bells because I thought, oh my God, I have had pain. But I just, again, thought that it was a result of having been to body pump and lift too much weight. Like I'd had this shooting pain through my arm and my boob, and I just thought, oh my God, I've really like been pushing the weights, you know, this week in class, and didn't think it could be anything more sinister than that. So Monday rolled on, I called the GP and I just said, look, I'm really quite concerned because I've been reading my symptoms and I'm really scared if, you know, these symptoms are signs of breast cancer. I think in my heart, I didn't think it was at that time because I'd never heard of anyone in their 30s ever having had breast cancer. And I'd never really, this sounds weird, but never been in the presence of anyone who spoke about breast cancer. And my maternal grandmother, so my mum's mum, had had breast cancer twice.
Right.
But it was never discussed. And I think that's part of that's cultural. So in the Indian culture, we just don't talk about things. You know, when someone's going through hard times, these walls come up and no one has a conversation about it. So I never for a minute thought this could be breast cancer, but called the doctor nonetheless and spoke to someone. I can't remember if it was a nurse or a doctor at the time, because the receptionist said, I'll put you through to someone. And they said, oh, no, I wouldn't worry too much. Just book the next available appointment, which, as you know, you wait weeks for a routine appointment at your doctor. So it was about 2.5 weeks before I got in to see the doctor. And then I became more and more aware of this inversion and the pains that were behind it in the time that sort of followed between then and the appointment. But
I think when you've got any pain at all, as soon as you recognize that pain, and then as soon as you read anything that it can be linked to cancer, that
just magnifies, doesn't it?
That's the only thing that you then think about.
And you've spent months ignoring it, and all of a sudden, like, every minute, every hour, you're like, it's there, it's growing, it's, you know, what if it is. So I went to this routine appointment. I saw a doctor, and she basically looked at my breast, she examined my breast, and then turned around and said, I wouldn't worry, there's nothing wrong with you, you're 33, you haven't had children, it's most likely a blocked milk duct. Keep an eye on it, and if you're concerned, come back. And by this time, I had Googled it so much that I was petrified of it being cancer. And I am quite stubborn, so I basically said I would really appreciate a referral to a breast clinic right now, because I'm quite concerned that just feeling around and sending me on my way isn't the right thing to do. And she said, no, you know, there's no point in sending you for a mammogram or anything. You're 33. It's going to, you know, if we give you a mammogram, your breast tissue's too dense. We won't see anything. And it's really not necessary at this point in time. And again, I just said, I'm not leaving this room without a referral. I would only feel comfortable having seen a consultant and had someone look into what's going on in my boob. So she did reluctantly make that referral for me and said, look, just go, you know, go to the breast clinic. The referral will be in the post. And hopefully, you know, you won't have anything to worry about anyway, but your mind will be put at rest. So I went off and went back to work that afternoon and thought, okay, this is fine. She's not worried. She can't feel anything in my boob. I'll get the next appointment through and I'll go and see the doctor and see what they say, the consultant. So I think it was about a week, maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less, and before my appointment at the consultant's was up in East Surrey. So I went along.
This is nearly 4 weeks after you...
After I'd acknowledged, it was over a month after acknowledging that something was not right. I went to East Surrey, and I had been again. I'd sort of slipped into this sort of blasé attitude because I'd seen a doctor who told me not to worry. I kind of was looking for someone to tell me not to worry. So I went in and I just sort of left work and I just said to the guy who I sit next to, I'll be back. I've just got a little appointment. I've got to give a blood test and I'll be back in no time at all. We're headed up. Saw the doctor, she sort of took me into her room, she examined my breast, and it was within seconds that the penny dropped for both of us that something was quite wrong here. So she just turned around and said to me, Krina, have you come on your own today? And I said, yes. And she then said, next time, please bring someone with you. And for me, I was like, well, why would I come again? Like, you know, I thought there was nothing wrong here. So I said, oh, why would there be a next time? And she said, well, you know, you have an inverted nipple. And I'll be honest, it's a sign of breast cancer. She goes, and then upon examination, I can feel a lump in your breast. So I was like, I saw my GP like a week ago and they said there was no lump in my breast. So what's going on? And she said, no, I, you know, it's behind the nipple. There is a lump there. I actually think I can feel two. Just carry on with your day, and we'll be in touch as soon as we can kind of get an appointment or get you seen to, we'll be in touch. So I really, like, I remember it now. I was in a daze. I kind of just walked out of the hospital like, have I got breast cancer? And what do you mean, just go back to doing whatever it was you were doing? Like, so I just got in my car and I drove back to work and I sat back in my desk, and my friend next to me was like, is everything okay? And I was like, yeah, fine. Like, you know, just kind of opened Excel and carried on number crunching. Like, it was the strangest thing ever. And I was at my desk literally probably for about another hour and a half, and my phone rang, and it was the hospital saying, we've got an appointment at Crawley Hospital for a mammogram today. Can you get there? Like, within half an hour. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure I can. Put the phone down and then just said to my colleague, I've got to go again. And he was like, oh, what's wrong? Like, how come you're off again? I said, oh, the blood sample's gone a bit funny. I need to go and give it again. And he was like, okay, fine, see you tomorrow. So I basically packed up my bags, went down to Crawley Hospital and had a mammogram that same day. Which, by the way, is really uncomfortable. went home and sort of digested it and said to Sati, you know...
I guess as well, like, I mean, for myself, I remember that sort of feeling of when you know that the doctor is, like, panicking and mm-hmm. is getting you in for things that...
you know that you this know is that not going to end well sort of thing. So you go through all of the motions and all of the tests and the scans and ultimately end up, you know, in this consultant's room ready to hear what you already know in your heart of hearts is going to be delivered to you. So we sat there and he just turned around and said, Krina, I'm really sorry to say you have noughties in your breast. And at first I kind of was like, what did he just say? So I turned around and said, so I have breast cancer. And he said, yes. And it's that thing, you know, we were talking about it a moment ago, that it's funny that consultants still don't want to use the word
cancer. Mean, yeah, I still, to be honest, I still have issues with saying it. I think saying have cancer, just, I think I often say I had cancerous cells.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not nice, is it? It's interesting that consultants seem to avoid the word as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I actually don't mind saying it now. I'm quite
more comfortable with it.
Yeah, quite a lot more comfortable with it. But we'd ended up in this situation, and I was just taking it in. And I think for me, it was literally, you know, confirming what I already knew. And I looked over at Sati, and he was crying, and I thought, oh, I hadn't prepared myself for that.
Do you know what? I don't think to this day. I know that, like, Mark tells me that he cried on occasion, but never in front of me, and I don't know what I would have felt like. I think, what was that like?
And similarly, I'd never seen Sati cry up until that point, and I think for me, I felt guilt, and maybe that's sort of, that guilt does stay with you throughout, really, on a level of some sort, but in that moment, I just looked at him, and I just thought, wow, I've caused you, you know, because of me, you're now crying, and I've brought that into our lives. And I had this overwhelming feeling of guilt, and then, like, I started to cry myself, because someone you love dearly is crying empathetically for you. So, you know, then the emotion really comes into it, and the reality of the situation comes into it, and we just sort of, you know, the Macmillan nurse came into the room, and she took us to a side room and started talking to us about the treatment plan, which at the time was just, I mean, I say just, it was, the plan was to have the left breast totally removed and radiotherapy to my chest wall. And when I say I cried, I didn't really sob or anything like that. I had tears in my eyes because I felt empathy towards Sati's situation, but I didn't have them for myself. And I, you know, the nurse was talking to me, and I was like, okay, fine, right, so you're going to cut my boob off, we're going to have radiotherapy, and then I'm going to get on with my merry little life. And actually, this was on a Wednesday. The Thursday, I went into work again, and I just said to my boss, hi, and I've got breast cancer, and I won't be in work for a little while, but I'm literally going to be back within 6 months, because I'm going to have my boob cut off, and I'm going to have radiotherapy, and nothing else is going to change in my life. And I think he looked at me like, okay, I think you're still in shock and you really shouldn't be in the office, and go home and digest it and take as long as you want. So I kind
but
of
it
did
in,
that.
But it's interesting then, because so many people that I've spoken to that have experienced the same thing did that, went back into work, tried to just get on with it. Yeah. I think it's a control thing.
Yeah, it's the only thing you can control. Yeah. So we did that, and in between I sort of spoke to my doc, I spoke to the consultant. He'd said to me, you know, you're looking at a 3 week wait for your mastectomy, I'll fit you in, and da da da. And bearing in mind we're now, like, you know, months on from the the point at which you found the inverted nipple, I a little light bulb went on in my head to say, hold on, you have private medical insurance through your employer. So I was like, oh, I think I've got private healthcare. And he was like, well, why have you been, like, waiting so long? Like, you could have had this all, you know, seen to in a much shorter time frame. And, you know, he goes, in which case we can do a mastectomy next week. See you on Wednesday. So I had a very short amount of time to come to terms with the fact I was losing this part of my body. Yeah. But weirdly, I was always okay with it. I think I'm one of those people who were like, well, do you know what? If I can cut it out, I've never been a booby person, if that makes sense. So I've never been like, ooh, look at my boobs. Or like, you know, I need to wear a top that shows my breasts off. Can I just say, we've got friends and brothers.
I am a booby person. And my brother's here. Yeah, we're talking about boobs.
Giggling.
But I am a booby person. I think, yeah, I think if I had to choose uterus or boob, I definitely would have. I like my boobs.
Yeah, so I wasn't worried about it. And so, you know, I was like, okay, well, we've got a week to get this, like, breast removed and it's fine. So the first thing I did was walk out of that appointment and I thought, well, now we have to tell people what's about to happen. And I'm very much a hold your shit together kind of person. Like, I don't really let people in. I do now, but at that time, no. I was, like, such a control freak. And I was like, who do I tell first? So one of my aunts, I'm incredibly close to her, and I thought, I want to tell her first. She lives down in Kent. So I basically got out of this thing and I said to Satty, I'm like, right, we're driving to Kent now. And he looked at me like, what? I said, we're going to go and tell that auntie and uncle down in Kent that, you know, I've got breast cancer. And he was like, oh, well, if that's who you want to tell first, off we go. So we got in the car and I don't even really remember the car journey. I just remember getting there and they have a shop and it was a midweek and, you know, you don't turn up on a Wednesday afternoon, like, for a cup of tea with no reason. So me and Satty walked in and they both looked at us like, what are you two doing here? Mm-hmm. And I just said, oh, I had the day off and we thought we'd come and see you. Da-da-da-da. And I said to my aunt, oh, let's go upstairs and make a cup of tea. So we went upstairs to the house and she was standing by the cooker and I thought, well, how do I tell this person, like, How do I actually say this out? Yeah, is it like she's literally making a cup of tea? What do I say to her? You know, and this is my mum's younger sister, and she, you know, she brought me up for the early part of my life, and you know, I see her as a second mum, and I just thought, well,
at this point, you hadn't told your mum.
I hadn't told my mum at this point, and I just sort of went to my aunt, and I looked at her, and I went, she's rambling on about the shop, and I just looked at her, and I went, I've got something to tell you, and I genuinely think she thought I was going to tell her I was pregnant. Like, genuinely thought. She was like, almost looked excited. And then she looked at me and I just said, I've got breast cancer. And her face was like, it was so sad. And you really feel like you're letting people down at that point in time. And you just, you don't want to see the pain in your family's eyes. And you don't want to put them through what you know you're going to have to go through. So, you know, I told her and then she was like, okay, well, let's just get through the next few weeks and get through, you know, your treatment. And, you know, as much as your mothers are in your life, they try and just comfort you and tell you it's all going to be okay. And even though she didn't know it was going to be okay. And, you know, we were just talking, you know, she was like, how did you find it? And I told her about the story and I don't know, it was just, you know, it was surreal having this conversation with them about breast cancer. And downstairs I was just wondering what the conversation was between my uncle and my husband, because, you know, my dad is not in my life whatsoever, so, you know, my uncle is almost the only father figure I've had for a very long time, and I couldn't tell him. So I said to Satty, you're gonna have to break it to him at some point down there. And they must have had the same conversation. And then the shop was closed and Satty and my uncle came upstairs, and Indian men are men of very few words anyway. I think men are generally men of few words, and an Indian man sort of has that extra barrier of emotion to him. And he just came up and gave me a hug and he just said, I'm so sorry. And I'll never forget that, because having not had a dad in my life to protect me or to look after me, to then have this man come up and empathise with me, I just thought, I didn't know how to process the emotion. And I'm not very good at accepting people's help or accepting or allowing vulnerability to show. And, you know, it was just one of the hardest things to deal with, that very first conversation. But I'm glad we did it in the way we did it, because they were the people who needed to hear it first, because, you know, my mum's more vulnerable, and I needed to say it to these people who are quite strong and who have each other to talk to when I walk away to discuss, you know, what they've just heard. So the four of us went out to dinner, and we almost ignored the conversations of the past 2.5 hours and tried to talk about something lighthearted, and, you know, the fact that the food we were eating wasn't quite what we thought we'd ordered, and the Toblerone cheesecake had no Toblerone in it. You know, like, the stupid things you say to avoid talking about the disease that's living inside of you. And that was that. And we kind of ended the day, and Satya and I came home, and I said to Satya, I feel relieved for sharing it with someone, because, you know, I'd been going through all of my tests, my biopsies, my ultrasounds, with no one knowing what I was going through. And I, even at work, I was just putting a mask on and getting through it, because I didn't want to share it until I'd heard it for real for myself. And it felt good to share, really, at that point. So we shared the shared the story, and we came home, and I think Satya was relieved to have had another male to talk to at that point. And as I left, I said to my aunt, well, now I've got to tell my cousins, so and my sister, obviously. So the next people on my list were my sister, my brother-in-law, and then my cousins, who were the children of the aunt and uncle I'd told already. And we never get together randomly midweek. It's, you know, everyone's at work, and I'd basically called them all up and said, look, can we all meet in Kenley for dinner? I need to talk to you. And they were like, oh, what? And then my cousin later told me that she phoned her mum to say, do I really need to go? Like, or is Karina just going to tell me she's pregnant? And then my auntie was like, no, you really need to go. Just go and have dinner with them and see what she's got to say to you. So we met at my sister's house, and we ordered, I can't remember what we had to eat, actually. And we're all huddled in the kitchen. And then I didn't really know when the right time was to say this, like before dinner, after dinner, when do you say it? So we kind of all got in this kitchen, and the four of us girls were there, and I just turned around and I just said to them, so I know this is weird that we're all here on a weekday, but I have to just tell you I've got breast cancer. And they like looked at me like, what? And then within seconds, everyone's eyes were filled up with tears, you know. And up until that point, you've held it together and you've delivered the message with no tears or almost no emotion. You just say the words, and they sort of just stood there and looked at me and almost didn't even know whether to hug me or not because of the shock of it. Like, what does Karina want us to do at this point? And I think it's really important to acknowledge the difficulties in this entire journey of the people that surround you, because whether it's cancer, whether it's heart failure, whether it's infertility, that's happening to you as the individual, and you have a support network, but who's supporting the people that support you? So, you know, my cars, they stood there, and then after a while, my sister broke the silence, and she just said, well, I guess it's the best cancer to have if you were going to have one. And I was like, in my head, I thought, what do I think about this comment? You know, it's the best cancer to have. And now you do hear it a lot now as well. Like, you know, if you're going to have a cancer, pick breast cancer, because the survival rates are good and the research is good and the therapy is good. Like, but is there a good cancer? Like, I don't think so. No. I don't think so whatsoever. But
no, but I think it is. It's people, isn't it? Want to just, do you know, it's funny. Someone recently told me about a cancer diagnosis, and I literally had no idea what to say to them. And yeah. I thought, this is stupid, because yeah. I should be like one person who does say something yeah. right to them, but I still don't think there's any, I don't think there is a right thing to say.
And
that's like a less offensive thing, yeah. thing to say.
I don't know but, what's right or wrong to say, you know, and I don't think anyone does, like, whether you've been through it or you haven't.
No,
I think,
but the other thing I've realised through going through it myself is that it's really important to say something.
Yes,
I think actually saying something is more important than
the awkward silence yeah. sort of situation. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, she broke the ice with that comment, and then we all started talking about it. And actually, it was great because it was a facilitator to actually yeah. now open a conversation about breast cancer and what it is we're dealing with, because up until now the lid has just been on the jaw so tight that no one's uttered a word about it. So again, we had a conversation about it, and then it was, the next person on my list was my mum, and you know, my mum and I are so close, and we've had a, we have a very, very tight relationship, almost to the point at which it was unhealthy. So, like I said earlier, you know, my dad's not in my life. For a long time, I became my mum's carer, I think. And my mum's, there's a point in our life, isn't it, where you start to parent your parents. And I think that was accelerated when my dad left us. I felt the need to look after and protect my mum. So I knew that was never going to be an easy conversation to have. And I'd left her till the last because I wanted my sister on my side. I needed her there when I told my mum. So I said to my sister, I go, we need to tell mum before, you know, because I'm having an operation now in about 3 days' time. And it was also my mum's birthday in 2 days' time. So I was like, right, I need to break this news to her, you know, let her know that it's going to be okay. And even whilst I'm planning it, I'm still protecting her and not thinking about myself. And I basically, my sister and I then went there on the weekend. We took both our husbands there and we were doing something so ordinary, like clearing out her footstool or something. And I said to my sister, well, I've got to tell mum now. So we sort of got her into this, like we'd got her a cup of tea and we were all just sitting around, and I just, my sister said to my mum, well, Queen has got something to tell you. And I think this is the hard thing of having been diagnosed 3 years after marriage, is everyone expects it to be a baby. You know, that's at that point,
you've got something to tell somebody.
Yeah, when you've got something you have to say, everyone expects that it's something to do with becoming a mum. And then when you hear the reality, it's just so polar opposite to what they're expecting to hear. So, you know, I just said, mum, I've got breast cancer. And I'm going to have a mastectomy in 2 days' time. And she just didn't know what to say, you know. And she was like, how, why haven't you told me? You know, why has it got to this point before you're saying something? And I said, I didn't know how to tell you. I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I didn't want you to then, she lived on her own. I didn't want to tell her this news and then her be on her own and just wallow in those thoughts, you know, and I didn't have the energy to be there to pick her up. So we kind of just, again, went over the same conversation of how many tests I'd been through, that it had been confirmed that I would have to have this mastectomy and that the surgery would be in a couple of days' time. And I was reassuring her at that point. I was like, it's going to be fine, though, because, you know, I'm just going to have my boob cut off and they don't think I'll have chemotherapy. So, you know, it'll be fine and I'll be back to work in a few months. You really shouldn't worry about this, mum. There's nothing, you know, overly wrong with me. Hello, I've got breast cancer, but here's me telling you that it's all going to be fine because I just want to protect the people I love. And we got that conversation out there. It was over and done with. And then we had dinner and my sister stayed over with my mum. And I'm sure that evening they had conversations that I probably still never know the content of them. And then, you know, the following one or two days later, I was in hospital, had my mastectomy, had my left breast removed, and sort of woke up after the surgery. And the consultant said, look, it was fine. The procedure went according to plan. We've taken samples from your lymph nodes, which are now in the lab. We're just checking for any spread outside of the breast tissue. But, you know, it looks as good as good can be at this point in time. So don't worry, just focus on your recovery. I had, because I had this private healthcare, I'd had a selection of oncologists. So I'd selected an oncologist at the Royal Marsden because I knew that was sort of a cancer specialist hospital. So as soon as I had an option of where to be treated, I knew that was where I would be treated. And that was something my cousins actually helped me with when we were talking after I'd shared the news with them. And they were like, look, if you can go to the Royal Marsden, you must go there because they have, you know, incredible oncologists there. And if there's an option, choose it. So I'd already chosen my oncologist, Professor Smith at Royal Marsden, you know, who is my saviour. And the appointments were coming in to then go and see him and have the next steps of treatment planned out. And we went back into clinic after my mastectomy the following Wednesday again, went to get the results of the tissue analysis. And we sat down in the room and it was almost like Groundhog Day because it was the same room, the same consultant, and you're sitting there waiting for news to be delivered. And he said, Queen, I'm really sorry. And I thought, oh no, now what's he going to tell me? And he goes, oh, we're going to have to change your treatment plan because when I've taken lymph nodes from under your armpit, they are marked, they're tumoured. I need to take the rest of them to see how bad the cancer may have spread outside of the breast tissue. So just to clarify, we all have, you know, we have breast tissue and then we have a lymphatic system that goes around our body, and that lymphatic system is great when it's
working properly
and treating infections, and it's, you know, it's doing what it needs to take white blood cells to and fro the body. But when you have a cancer in your breast, it also acts as a bit of a travelator for the cancer to make its way around your body. And so he'd taken some of these lymph cells, and it had proved that the cancer was trying to get out from the breast tissue and move its way around. So he goes, I'm going to have to take you back into theatre, take some more lymph nodes out, and then we're going to have to reassess. So back into surgery I went. I had all of my lymph nodes out. He then put them, you know, we had an analysis done. I went back into clinic and he said, okay, 30 to 40% of your lymph nodes are shown as tumoured. So whilst it's not secondary breast cancer, it is still a spread out of the initial site. So you now need to have chemotherapy. And I just didn't ever want to hear those words. You know, I spent so long convincing myself I was only ever going to have a mastectomy and radiotherapy, that the words chemotherapy just were the last things I wanted to hear. And I think he felt a bit awkward saying it to me as well, because he was very like, I remember him turning around going, chemotherapy, now I don't want you to think of this as a negative thing, embrace chemotherapy, get through it and you'll be fine. And then he was almost like ushering us out the door, and I thought, oh, okay, fine. So we left, and then Satya and I stood in this car park, and I found myself unable to move. I just stood there, and then Satya sort of held back and looked at me, and I was like, I can't do this. And I burst into tears in the middle of the car park. And that was the first time I really released the emotion that was associated with this disease. I think up until then I'd held it in, and I thought I can just sort of sweep it under the carpet, the whole thing, and be back to my normal self. And I think chemotherapy is just, we know it's harsh as a treatment, but emotionally and physically it strips you off so much. And ultimately, had I never had chemotherapy, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because I wouldn't have lost my fertility. So you know, I at that point I didn't really realize that was one of the side effects. I was more worried about losing my hair. And I just said to Sati in the car park, I go, I can't do it, I don't want to lose my hair. And I mean, it sounds crazy, doesn't it? I've got this disease in me, but I don't want to lose my hair.
But I think it's because I was, I think I didn't ever have to have chemotherapy. And just listening to you, it sends shivers down my spine, thinking that would have been something perhaps that, had the outcome been different, I would have had to have. But there's something about losing your hair that just feels like it's a part of you.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it was such a big part of me. And I think it's not just the fact that you physically lose your hair. I think it's because once you lose your hair, you become a victim, and you become the person that everyone in the supermarket looks at,
sees,
and you're,
you can hide it.
Yeah.
Otherwise
you can. You can normalize everything else. You can put a mask on, but if you've lost, and I didn't acknowledge that it was more than your hair, you know, the eyebrows, the eyelashes, everything about you, chemotherapy strips it away. And that is what I hadn't prepared myself for, because I'd convinced myself it was never going to happen. So we went home, you know, and we prepared for the appointment with the oncologist to discuss the chemotherapy regime as I got over my mastectomy healed. And I walked into the Marsden, and I remember thinking, oh my God, how have I ended up in a cancer hospital? Like, it seems like, and now time's now moving really quickly. So it's almost like when you find this inverted nipple and you start Googling it and you're waiting for appointments, time is moving incredibly slowly because you're waiting for a diagnosis. And then you're diagnosed, and then you're like, you're diagnosed, your breast's been removed, you're having chemotherapy, your lymph nodes are out, and you're now in the hospital. Like, and it was like, wow, that's just happened in the blink of an eye. I haven't even had time for this wound to heal. And I was talking to the consultant, and in between, I'd had a phone call with my auntie, the auntie who I'd spoken to very first about my diagnosis, and she said, Krina, one of my customers has been through this, and you need to know that you might have an issue with your fertility when it comes to chemotherapy, and make sure you ask to have your eggs harvested. Make sure you don't forget to ask to have your eggs harvested. And she told me it 2 or 3 times, and I thought, that's an odd thing for someone to say, but okay. So I went into this room and they told us all about the treatment regime, and then I said, before the oncologist even said it, I said, I want to have children. And he said, that was my very next point I was going to say to you, you know, you're newlywed, would you want a family in the future? And if so, we need to talk about it. So he then told me, you know, there's a chance that the drugs would leave me infertile. By this time, we knew that my tumour was very sensitive to oestrogen. So they measure the sensitivity to hormone of your breast tumour. And I was 100% sensitive to oestrogen, 100% sensitive to progesterone, which means that your tumour is feeding off hormones in the body. So, you know, it was an open conversation. There was 2 issues. 1, I could be left infertile. And 2, even if I wasn't infertile, carrying a pregnancy involves coming off medication. And then it also involves hormone being present in the body, which could then feed a rogue cancer cell that's been left behind somewhere. So we kind of knew that motherhood was always going to be a bit of a struggle. And he said, you know, you've got 2 options. You can harvest your eggs, or we can give you this other drug. It's called Zoladex. What it will do is put your ovaries to sleep and hopefully protect your eggs. So when you're off treatment and you're stable, we can then look to see if you want to naturally conceive, or if you then need to have another form of treatment to become a parent. And I guess no one wants to wait for the unknown, do they? So I said to him, well, I don't want to wait and see if your drug works, because if it doesn't work, then it's a little bit too late. So I want to harvest my eggs now. And he said, okay, fine, let's do that. So I'm going to do the referral into a reproductive centre. I know a doctor up at St. Bart's Hospital in London, and she will look after you, get this done, but we don't have long. Like, I need to get you on treatment, so you have, you know, you have this one cycle and then you need to start chemotherapy. And it was ironic because, you know, you have to do this IVF type process in sync with your own body's natural cycle, and then you've got to account for the fact you're about to start chemotherapy. Emotionally, you don't have a chance to process any of what's going on. I basically went home, got this call from Bart's Hospital saying, can you come up for a scan and to start IVF tomorrow? So I went along and we started the process of going through what medication we would need to take to stimulate my egg production, the days, the time frame. And I remember it really clearly because it was the day before my 34th birthday that we were at this hospital appointment, and that on my 34th birthday I started injecting to stimulate my ovaries to produce eggs. And it's just a blur. It's just such a, like, you haven't come to terms with having lost a body part. You haven't come to terms with the fact that you've just told your mum you've got cancer. You haven't come to terms with the fact you're about to have chemotherapy, yet you're trying to produce a life. So every time I would look down to inject in my stomach, I would kind of be looking at the boob and thinking about cancer, not about what I'm doing when I'm injecting in the hope of creating a life. And when we did eventually sort of get to the egg collection day, and, you know, that you go in and you have this procedure done, and, you know, it does feel like the entire autumn 2013 was just procedure after procedure after procedure, be it oncology or IVF or whatever else you decide to have done at the time. We just went in, we had these eggs collected. I came home the following day and got a call from the reproductive centre. And this call will always stick in my head because I think for some people it must be a really happy moment. And a lady phoned me up from the hospital at Barts and she said, oh, Karina, I'm just calling you to say that, you know, yesterday we collected 13 eggs from you and we used ICSI to fertilise them. And we now have 11 embryos on ice. That's an amazing result. And I just wanted to congratulate you. And she was so happy in her tone. And I guess for some people that is incredible and they would be celebrating it. And as she was speaking, I just wanted to hang up because my heart was saying, why would you want to create a life when you don't know if you're going to make it through cancer? And I never, ever celebrated those embryos that were created. And I just kept thinking, why did I bother? Like, and I even thought that for a long time afterwards, like, why have I bothered collecting these? Because I might be dead in 2 years' time.
Mm.
And then I've created an embryo that I'm never going to use. And I, you know, Satya and I then also had conversations later about if I died from my breast cancer, I would give him consent to use my embryos to create a child that would then be a part of me, that would live on. And that is the part of this world we live in, of, you know, infertility and cancer living hand in hand, that is so hard to digest mentally and emotionally. And I would be lying if you still don't have those thoughts today of, if my cancer recurs now, am I going to leave two children behind or one child behind? You know, what am I going to leave behind? And am I foolish to have had a child knowing I've had a disease that...
But I think you do, and you do think those, and I think those thoughts are entirely sort of normal. I think, you know, you go through that, am I being selfish?
Yep.
Should I wait 5 years until my 5 years clear before I even sort of start to live this? Again?
Yeah.
But then I just think you've got to just remind yourself that, like, really horrendous things happen to people every day, and you could get knocked over by a bus.
Yeah.
You know,
at
any point. Yeah. And then what do you do? Just never have children. And I mean, there's always sort of percentages, but I just think you just can't. I think you've got to block those thoughts.
Yeah. And I'm not, you know, they don't consume me, and I don't ever think I've made the wrong decision having had a child in the way we've had children. But it is, I guess, the part of the reason we do this podcast is to raise awareness of what people are going through when they embark on a surrogacy journey. And the thing about having had a child through surrogacy is to remember there was more often than not a lot of trauma that preceded that journey. And this, I guess, was just the beginning for me.
And a lot of thought that I think a lot of people don't necessarily see, you know, goes into these things. You know, to think that you just actually just all, you know, went all gung-ho into it is just not the case. There's so many different things that you have to think about. And again, you know, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do that, is because we wanted to bring those issues to the forefront. I think for a lot of couples who haven't had fertility issues, there's not perhaps as many things that they think about before they embark on having on a child. And I think when you've gone through what we've been through, there's just so many questions that you have to ask yourself and your partner and your families.
And your surrogate.
And your surrogate, yeah.
So, you know, we went through the IVF treatment, we started chemotherapy. You know, the side effects were the side effects, and maybe we'll talk about them in other podcasts, but, the expected happened, my hair fell out. And I even now say that the thing that cancer stole from me was my femininity. You know, visually, my hair was gone, my breasts were gone. I ended up having a double mastectomy. So, you know, I lost my hair, I lost my breasts, I lost my fertility. And I would sit there thinking, what have I got to offer as a woman? What have I got to offer as a wife? You know, I can't produce, I can't carry my husband's child, you know, I can't bear a child. I can't look like the woman he married, because I now have no boobs. And then I was bald. Like, you know, what is it that this guy would stick around for? But, you know, I'm very fortunate that he did stick around. So we continued on the oncology route, and I, you know, finished chemotherapy, finished radiotherapy, had a double mastectomy, and later had a reconstruction. This now is 2 years later, in 2015. And I think that's important, because cancer doesn't just come and go, you know, and I think that's something I always speak about. The life with cancer is almost as long as you live, that the side effects will be there, and the sort of damage will all be there. And, you know, we got to the end of 2015, and I remember sort of celebrating and saying to Satya, well, we should go on a holiday now, you know. we're done with cancer in its active form, and we booked a trip to Vancouver in the summer of 2016. So we're in a really good place now. I'd healed sort of from my mastectomy, and yeah, I was very tired because I think it had all taken it out of me. But we were, you know, mentally we were looking to the future, and I had been looking at surrogacy as well, and I'd been on forums for a while, just sort of kind of keeping my options open at this point, not definitively sort of thinking I'm ready to have a kid, this is what I'm going to do. But
because at this point you could potentially still,
I mean, at this point the conversation was I could carry, but there would have to be consideration given to when. So we would probably evaluate. So my oncologist had said, no, we wouldn't do it before 3 years post-diagnosis. So you're going to have to wait for 3 years. Then let's have a think about it, see where we are with your treatment. If you want to have a break from your drugs, potentially at that point, or you could wait for 5 years and then have a break. But I always had this thing inside of me that said, if you break from your drugs and fall pregnant, have a child, and then your cancer comes back, how will you feel? And not only towards myself, but also towards my child. Mm-hmm. Like, would I feel like, well, because I brought you into this world, I'm now going to die because I've got secondary breast cancer, because my cancer's come back, because I've come off my drugs and there's estrogen in my blood. And this had been with me for a long time. And I think in my heart of hearts, I knew I wouldn't put myself or a future child at risk. So I had already been looking into surrogacy, because I felt it was the safest way to become a mum. And I had been sort of speaking to surrogates, and again, we'll talk about that conversation on another episode. But we went off to Vancouver in the summer of 2016 to sort of celebrate the future, I think, it's fair to say. And we got on the flight and, you know, we were so excited. We were meeting some friends over there who we'd met when we had backpacked around the world in 2011. We'd met them. And we hadn't seen them, and we sort of reconnected thanks to social media. And we were like, oh my God, you know, we're going to go and see them. And we're so excited. And we landed in Vancouver. As soon as we were picked up, we sort of went to our friend's house and we're having a sandwich. And I was like, oh, I feel a bit ropey. It must be the sort of 11 odd hour flight, whatever it was, to get over there. And just had a bit of downtime, but acknowledged that I wasn't feeling very well. 24 hours later, I was really struggling with my chest. I was like, very tight chested, struggling to breathe and coughing an awful lot. So I said to Sati, oh, I think I've got like a virus from the flight, maybe bronchitis or something like that, you know, need to get to a pharmacy. And we were now sort of out of city and on a little break for the weekend with our friends. And I'd said to my friend, oh, you know, I might need to get to a pharmacy, you know, when it's convenient and the kids are asleep or whatever. Let's have a think about it. She goes, okay, see how you go tonight, and then let's decide tomorrow what to do. So the next day, sort of, everyone else sort of had a day of activity planned, and I just sort of stayed put in one place because I didn't have anything in me to move. I was so tired and constantly coughing. Couldn't lie down, couldn't go to sleep. And that night I said to Fiona, I think I need to head back to Vancouver and just get someone to look at me. I feel really awful and I don't want it to ruin the rest of my trip. So I want to try and get some medication as soon as possible. So we went back to Vancouver, and the next day I was going to go and see a doctor. I didn't even wake up. I hadn't got to sleep, but by the time it was 4 a.m, I was so unwell. Sati was sort of sitting up with me and we were like, we need to get medical attention ASAP. My friend woke up, and luckily there was a sort of a very early morning walk-in centre that was open, and she drove us down there. We sat on the bed with the doctor, and he examined me, and then he said, oh, well, I don't think you've got bronchitis. I think you need to be seen at a hospital. There's something wrong with you, but I can't diagnose you here. And I just started crying, like spontaneously sobbing. And he's just turned around and said, what's the matter? And I said, oh, I've got cancer in the lung, haven't I? And he was like, no, I didn't say that at any point. But this is just where the mind of a cancer patient goes. Yeah. Well, I'm chronic. I feel really unwell. I feel sick. I can't breathe. I must have cancer.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, don't think that. Let's get you to a hospital and get you examined and figure out what's wrong with you. So I got transferred to a university hospital locally, and spent about 7 or 8 hours there with them trying to examine me and figure out what was wrong. So they did a CT scan. I was, you know, hooked up to IVF drugs. hooked up to IV drugs. And just you know, so many medics came in, but nothing was progressing. No one ever said, this is what's wrong with her. And then after like a very long time, they turned around and said, we can't diagnose you. We don't know what's wrong. We're transferring you to Vancouver General Hospital, where they'll have more specialists who will have to examine you in more detail to figure out what's going on. And by this time, I just couldn't breathe. You know, I had oxygen, but I was still really struggling. Got transferred to VGH. We were in sort of the equivalent of their A&E center, and basically I was now slipping in and out of consciousness, and I remember Satty being there, then I remember him not being there. Mm-hmm. And there are real gaps in my knowledge of what happened on that night, but what I do remember is that I was cannulated in my all up my hand into my feet and into my legs, because they were just running out of veins to get lines into me. There was oxygen mask was put on my face, sort of the normal nose and mouth one, and my saturation on the monitor just kept dropping and dropping and dropping, and the nurse kept coming in, and I just kept hearing her going, she's desaturating. And then eventually they put this sort of, I can only describe it as a Darth Vader mask over my face. I think it's called a BiPAP, having looked it up since, which basically formed a seal all the way around my entire face, and it forced the air into my airways. And that was the only thing that actually eased my breathing. So it looked horrendous, but it meant I could actually then start to become more coherent. And every doctor that came in asked the same questions about my medical history. They asked the same questions about my chemotherapy. And Satty was getting really frustrated with me having to try and answer. And he actually at one point just said, can someone just read the notes? Because it reminded me what Mark was saying earlier. So he goes, can you just read the notes before you come in and stop making her answer the questions? Because look at her, she can't even speak. And we were both really, really conscious at this time that we're in a foreign country. You know, we don't have any support network here. My observations on this screen were obviously off the scale. You know, we'd had so many medics come into my room that this was never going to be a simple, easy to deal with situation. And I said to Satty, if I die here, just say goodbye to my mum, because I'm not going to get back to England to say goodbye to her. And that was one of the hardest times. You know, we didn't know what was wrong, but we knew it was dire, because I wasn't able to breathe. And then eventually, after all of these doctors coming in, someone said, can someone please call cardiology? We need some cardiac care. We need a cardiologist to come and look at her. So after a little while, this cardiac team came in, and they didn't say anything to me. They just sort of brought in their ultrasound and let me know I was okay in their hands, and opened up my chest and put the ultrasound on my chest. And at the same time, a consultant just bent down and whispered in my ear, so I didn't have to say anything. He just said, squeeze my hand if you had a chemotherapy that was red in colour. And I did, and I knew this, and I was conscious enough to say yes. So I nodded my head and I said yes, and I squeezed his hand. And instantly, they just looked, him and this other guy looked at each other. They said, she is in acute heart failure. Get her to cardiac intensive care now. And I, at that point, thought I was going to die, because I'd never heard the words heart failure. And I think anyone who does hear them would just think, well, if your heart's failed, how do you live? You know, and Masati and I got taken into this room, and at that point I said to him, you know, I really said to him, I might not make it back home. You know, am I going to die here? And I think we had a moment in Vancouver that we both acknowledged that this could be it. And if it was, I was going to be gone before my loved ones ever saw me, sort of thing, because we'd seen how quickly this had progressed from getting off a plane and being able to walk and talk and breathe to now being in a bed, in and out of consciousness, needing help to breathe. And then, you know, they sort of stabilised me. A consultant came in and she said, you know, you are in acute heart failure. Your heart function is somewhere around 6%. You know, you're not oxygenating. Your lungs are full of fluid. We're going to try and get as much fluid off your chest as possible to ease the pressure and to try and get your heart pumping, but your heart is dilated and it's just not able to push the blood around your body. So, you know, this isn't a great situation. And by this point, my sister had been informed of what was going on, and she was booking a flight to come out to Vancouver to be with us. And I said to the doctor, I said, well, am I going to die? And she said, well, it's a very serious illness, and until we actually start to treat you, we will not know. And I kind of just thought, well, it would always go back to my mum, you know. Much as I was trying to protect her when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, now I'm like, well, now I might die and she might never know. But I never told her I had heart failure when I was in Vancouver. And so my sister came out, and I had recorded voice notes to all of my loved ones to say, if I don't come back, this is what I want to say to you. So I left them, and they're probably on my one of my memory sticks or something somewhere. And I'd recorded all these messages, and I didn't know what to say to my mum, so I didn't ever record one. And my sister then got to Vancouver. I had actually, by this was sort of like day two or day three of being in intensive care, started to respond to drugs, and thought, well, there might actually be light at the end of this tunnel, and this might not be my time, and I might actually make it through. So I kind of lived for the day then, and I didn't think too much about whether I'd make it or not, and I didn't record any more messages, and I've just focused on getting better. And weirdly enough, I did start to get better, and got out of intensive care after a week or so in there, and then another 10 days in the general hospital, and I was just breathing on my own, and I was responding to medication, and like, I was by no means fit. I was still having to be wheeled everywhere in a wheelchair, but I wasn't at death's door. So we ended up going to the hospital for outpatient appointments. We rented an apartment in Vancouver to stay in, because I wasn't allowed to fly. I wasn't allowed to leave the country. And then after sort of 2 weeks, my sister came back home to go back to work, and I'd stabilised. And they were like, well, this is incredible. You're doing really well, but you can't get on a plane yet. You're going to have to stay here. So we stayed for about, I think it was about 8 weeks. And I would keep going to outpatient appointments. I mean, there's worse places in the world to be stuck. It was like, you know, the most beautiful place to be, I guess, left landlocked, like I couldn't go anywhere. And we sort of just took it in, and Satie would wheel me around the entire city in my wheelchair, and he was like, you're not going to miss out on seeing this city. We're going to go and see everything that we had planned to see on this holiday. We are going to go and see it with, you'd say, me and him, my friend Fiona, and the kids. We still did everything. Like, it was just slightly different. Like, I had to go in a wheelchair because I had no breath to catch. I walked, I couldn't breathe, but I was still alive. And I remember thinking, well, this is better than the alternative, isn't it? So if I'm now going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, I'm still going to be here. But day by day, I would feel myself getting stronger. And we got to sort of 6 weeks, and they were like, you can start thinking about flying home now. We think you'll be okay. And my heart had gone from a 6% ejection fraction, which is the pumping percentage at which your heart pumps blood around your body, to 12%. So we doubled it, right? And I didn't think I was dying now. Now I knew I was going to get home. And we basically eventually booked a flight home. I took my first business class flight. I mean, I don't think there'll ever be another one, but, I arrived home with sort of oxygen on hand and with a nurse escorting me. Came back, and it was only when I got back that I told my mum I'd had heart failure. So in between,
what did you tell your mum in terms of why you were away?
So basically, my sister said to my mum, "Oh, I've got a work trip in Canada, so I'm now going to go and catch up with Krina and Satie, who are on holiday there." To which my mum was like, "Oh, that's nice, lovely." And then it went a bit quiet when things were really like dark in hospital, and no one really contacted her, and we would just WhatsApp her, and my sister basically sent her a message saying, we're traveling, we're going to be in the mountains, don't expect to hear from us. So then that bought us 5 days while we were in hospital to kind of get stronger. And then my sister would just go outdoors and video call her and say, oh, yeah, Karina's just gone for a walk. Or, like, we would just not tell her, and I would not go on the phone because I was obviously in hospital gowns and still in connected to a bed. And then when we got discharged, initially we were in a hotel. So we made a very thought through video call. And, you know, we hid everything that made me look sick. And we put some dressing gowns on and we made a call. And we're like, oh, hi, Mum, we've got Wi-Fi. We've just been to the spa, look. And we got these dressing gowns on. And she goes to my sister, are you not coming home? When are you coming back? And my sister was like, oh, well, we're just going to travel a bit more and then I'm going to come back. But Karina and Satya are having an amazing time. They've actually taken unpaid leave from work to stay here for another 2 months. And that was our plan. We just told her that. And then my sister went back to England and she dealt with whatever questions that might have been, you know, angled at her from my mum. And I didn't really call her much again afterwards. I would send her the odd picture when I was like in Woodland and I'd be like, we're having a great time. And it was only when I got back to England,
you told her,
that I sat her down in the same sitting room, in the same sofa, that I told her I had breast cancer. And I turned around and I said, oh, I haven't been jollying it up in Vancouver. I suffered heart failure and I nearly died, and, you know, but I'm fine now and I'm here. And I didn't want to tell you when, because it was that thing, she was in England on her own. She didn't have anyone to turn to. And what would she do? Because my sister was in Canada with me, and who would her support network be? So we felt that protecting her in that way was the only way to deal with this. So that's what we did. And then we came back, and kind of, I was just getting about on a wheelchair for a long time, and Satya was just wheeling me around everywhere. And eventually the strength came back, and, you know, the rehab came, and we got to this point of being able to walk, and then being able to, you know, walk a bit further and testing myself every step of the way. And, you know, my body is just incredible. It's healed.
God, so that's incredible. And I've just been really quiet then as well, because that was the first time I've actually heard that part of the story. We've done the cancer bit before, but yeah, that's incredible. So was it, what in terms of what actually led you to surrogacy then, was it the cancer or the heart failure, or
it was almost a combination of the both. I think when I received my cancer diagnosis, I started to look into the world of surrogacy as an option, and definitely something I thought I might pursue one day. And then when I had heart failure, I had quite an honest conversation with my cardiologist, and he made it clear that I wouldn't be able to carry a child and continue on my medication. So the question would then be, you know, would you come off your medication to try and have a child, which would put your health at risk and your heart and everything else at risk. And I guess for me, I've always said I wouldn't put my life at risk to bring a child into the world, because it's so complex from your sort of the mind point of view on how you would cope with that. So I guess sort of cancer led me to surrogacy, but heart failure kind of forced me down that route with no other option.
Yeah, so the option was completely gone. And I think that is the case for a lot of people who end up looking into surrogacy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never come into surrogacy without having a past. It's not an easy option, is it? So, you know, we both know that it takes a lot of focus and energy and time, and, you know, it works, it doesn't work, there are risks. So yeah, I guess, you know, it's a beautiful world, but most heterosexual couples who end up having to undergo a surrogacy journey have got a story to tell.
And have suffered quite a bit of heartache,
yeah,
I think, beforehand. Yeah, thank you for that. I know
that's
hard going.
Yeah, it's not easy, is it, to talk about these things again. And I thank you if you're still listening, because
you've got mine next.
So. Yeah.
Hi next.
Honestly, this podcast is not designed to make you cry.
It's going to be happy eventually. It's happy. It, you know.
Yeah.
We're now here with three lovely little girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it gets better, but before it gets better, you've got my story next, and then yeah, we promise. Then we start to explore surrogacy.
Yes, and I can't wait.
No,
so we'll see you next time.
Yes, bye. See you then. Bye.